was designed to exploit all the things that comic books can do, and that no other medium can. I wanted to show off just what the possibilities of the comic book medium were. The most effective and influential reading of Watchmen came with its gloss on the idea of fantastical characters confronting the quotidian existence of the real world. If your superhuman boyfriend teleports you through time and space, you just might get sick to your stomach and vomit. If you maintain a secret crime cave, it might just require a lot of expensive upkeep and cleaning fees. If you gained your astonishing powers from potent radiation, you might just give your sidekick cancer. And of course, if you were the mightiest being in the world, you might just want to control it. In a sequence of panels where an older, paunchier version of Night Owl gives the retired superheroine Silk Spectre, whom he is awkwardly trying to seduce, a tour of his secret crime cave, he admits, "Eventually I realized the comedian was right. It's all crap, dressed up with a lot of flash and thunder. I mean, who needs all this hardware to catch hookers and purse snatchers? I mean, really? Huh. What's that? Prototype exoskeleton. First time I tried moving in it, it broke my arm. Never again. Jesus, that sounds like the sort of costume that could really mess you up. Is there any other sort?" "Here is the primary difference between the before and after Watchmen scenario," said writer J. Michael Straczynski. "Before Watchmen, the primary threats or darkness in comic books was about some supervillain's complicated plot to seize all the gold in the world. What Watchmen did was bring in the larger social elements. It spoke of the darkness inside of us, not just the external threats, and that was something that galvanized the industry. When the series was ultimately completed and eventually published in paperback, Watchmen became the darling of literary critics, a pop culture manifesto that could be taken seriously. In a 2005 review in the New York Times, Dave Itzkoff wrote, "If we imbue our champions with the weaknesses of ordinary mortals," Moore asks, "and confine them to a cosmos where good and evil are subjective notions and right never triumphs over wrong, what's the point of having heroes at all?" Watchmen became one of the most imitated comic books of all time. One trope, about a government commission that banned superheroes, would pop up again in nearly a dozen different storylines in various comics over the years. And the book's mature themes, stark visuals, and undercurrent of nihilistic violence would feed the undercurrent of superhero comic books far into the 21st century. According to Len Wein, Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns were both very violent books. They were meant to be exceptions to the rule. They weren't intended to be a blueprint for the industry to follow. They were intended to be something to show you, here's what could have happened. Let's not go do that. But they were hugely successful, and so everybody started to do those books. As much as Moore borrowed from the real world also tapped into Watchmen. In 1987, the Tower Commission Report, which investigated the Reagan administration's questionable dealings in supplying arms to foreign radical forces, came out with a condemnation of the administration's, quote, "lax attitude to international law." "Quis custodiet ipsos custodes," ran the epigraph of the report, translated as, "Who watches the watchman?" The same slogan that runs through the Moore and Gibbons saga. Given the immense influence and cultural imprimatur of Watchmen, perhaps Frank Miller's assessment of Alan Moore's occupational status was incorrect. Perhaps Moore was not the coroner of the superhero world at all, but rather its psychotherapist. A psychotherapist who snuck away from his patients during the last 2 weeks in August and hightailed it to a small city in England instead, leaving his poor, pathologically damaged super clients to fend for themselves. When the Bullpen Quits, Image Comics. It's probably not coincidental that I is the first letter in Image Comics. When seven of the comic book industry's most popular artists stepped away from the corporate halls of Marvel and DC to form the most successful publishing consortium outside of the Big Two since the days of Captain Marvel in the 1940s, they were asserting their independence and their personal visions. Some in the comic book industry exhume the same snarky comment bandied about when Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, and D.W. Griffith broke away from the Hollywood studio system to create United Artists in 1919. The lunatics have taken over the asylum. Fans and older readers, however, were thrilled to have a new, independent company that had the motivation and the talent to bring another generation of characters to the superhero universe. The seven founders of Image, Eric Larson, Todd McFarlane, Mark Silvestri, Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, Jim Valentino, and Wells Portacio, possessed powers far beyond those of mortal comic book artists. They were superhero superstars, artists who had cultivated a loyal following with their names burnished on covers and type almost as large as the superhero logos. McFarlane's idiosyncratic and fanciful rendition of Spider-Man produced a 2 million copy seller with Spider-Man No. 1 in 1990. Liefeld's sleek steroidal style kickstarted the 4 million copy selling X-Force No. 1, featuring the previously dubbed New Mutants. In the big stakes poker game of Blockbuster Comics, Jim Lee saw his colleagues and raised them. In 1991, utilizing his skill for populating his panels with pulsating power with X-Men No. 1, which set the record for a single title, 7.8 million copies. With such success, McFarlane, Liefeld, and Lee had everything a comic book artist could want. Except control. Since the days of Siegel and Schuster, publishers held almost all of the cards. Although by the 1990s, artists and writers were gaining some concessions from the publishers, the return of original art, a small share of royalties, top billing, and so forth, they were still confined by the fact that the superheroes they worked on and adored were owned by an increasingly bureaucratic corporate structure. An artist such as McFarlane could take a character like Spider-Man into the creative and financial stratosphere, but at the end of the day, Spidey had to swing back to corporate headquarters and report to the board of directors and their investors. As Larry Martyr, Image's executive director, put it, "In the comics field, you have two choices. Work on what you own, or work on something someone else owns. Period." By mid-1991, Liefeld and McFarlane were feeling particularly discontent with Marvel, which was putting limitations on what they could and could not draw or publish outside the company. There had been informal conversations among the duo and other artists about forming separate imprints, perhaps overseen by Malibu Comics on the West Coast. Around Christmas 1991, Liefeld, McFarlane, and Silvestri were in New York City for a highly publicized auction of original comic book art, including their own, and realized this was the moment to come together. As McFarlane, a baseball fanatic, put it, "I was always aware that the publishers can rotate you one at a time. You see it in sports. You can get rid of one player, they bring in another guy, and eventually the franchise is okay. But instead of us all going away one by one and doing an independent book each, why don't we do it together at the same place and leave on the same day? Make the impact." The key, according to McFarlane, was to engage Jim Lee, who was considered to be the golden boy of comics, a well-liked and amiable collaborator who had none of his colleagues' reputations as hotheads. Like many a super team before them, the seven artists realized that, combined, their strengths were exponentially more powerful. They called a meeting with the senior editorial staff at Marvel, the company where they all became celebrities, and announced, as McFarlane says, "We're leaving. We know we don't own your characters. We're not here to negotiate. We don't want anything. We're just going to tell you our reasons why we're leaving so that you may in the future do something about it, so that next week you don't get another seven guys coming in the room saying they're leaving." Marvel, somewhat condescendingly, wished them the best of luck, and when the elevator opened up on the ground floor, McFarlane and co. found themselves the co-conspirators of a new company, Image Comics. If they were daunted at the challenge of taking on two publishers who, between them, had a 95% market share, they didn't show it. "We weren't building a nuclear plant," said McFarlane. "We were putting ink on paper. Ink on paper? We got this thing down." Image set up shop on the West Coast, under the initial aegis of Malibu Comics. The seven creators had their own respective studios within the publishing company, with two inviolate tenets. One, Image would not own any creator's work, the creator would, and two, no Image partner would interfere, creatively or financially, with any other partner's work. CNN's Moneyline program got a hold of the story, and after they broadcast the news that Marvel's seven top artists had bolted from the firm, Marvel's stock took a considerable hit. The program compared Image's secession to a brain drain and stated that the box office appeal of the individual artists superseded that of the Marvel characters they had been hired to illustrate. CNN predicted that readers might follow the Image artists to their new company, quote, "the way record buyers follow a rock star." Being compared to rock stars suited the Image creators just fine as they prepared to launch their respective titles in the late spring, early summer of 1992. By and large, their enormous expectations were met, breaking all records for a non-DC Marvel title. Liefeld's debut book, Youngblood, sold 1.5 million copies. McFarlane's Spawn broke that record within weeks by selling 2 million copies of the first issue. Lee's intergalactic internecine Wildcats series would consistently top 1 million copies per issue during the first months of its run. Inevitably, those remarkably high print runs became unsustainable. The utopian vision of Image Comics also proved difficult to sustain. Although, after its first year, Image was successful enough to break away from Malibu, some of the creators had difficulty meeting deadlines. Getting these highly anticipated books into stores became problematic, and that created an unfortunate breach of trust with loyal readers. Jim Lee would sell his Wildstorm line to DC Comics in 1998, and gradually the original seven-person partnership would splinter off. Even though the opportunity for creative freedom at Image was seductive to many outside artists, as Larry Mortar put it, they wanted the great power, but not the great responsibility, of owning and controlling their own intellectual property. For some, the story of Image Comics is a paradigm of any new business model. A company founded on independence from corporate structure had better not throw out the baby of a well-run machine with the bathwater of bureaucratic interference. For others, it was significant that the creators at Image were all artists first and writers second. As Grant Morrison put it,
"They'd grown up in Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, but they were a lot, they weren't as literary at all, any of them. They came from an art background, and Stan's comics were created from a literary standpoint, and so were those DC comics of the 80s. They were writer-driven. But Image was artist-driven, so it was about sensation. And after, as I said before, after several years of literary and experimental and adult comics, I think American superhero fans just wanted sensation. And the generation that was arising at that time were not interested in poetry or theatre. They were a kind of River's Edge generation, if you remember that movie. It was disaffected suburban kids who'd grown up on wrestling and heavy metal and goth, and a lot of it was trying to articulate what a new young generation was like, who'd basically grown up very cynical in the midst of plenty.
Certainly, the Image heroes were grittier and overstepped the usual moral principles found in mainstream superhero comics. Some of the characters wouldn't consider themselves heroes at all. The company also never bothered with any restrictions from the Comics Code Authority. Still, McFarlane's Spawn held on, through his and various hands, for more than 200 issues and counting. Eric Larson's Savage Dragon, about an amiable hulking green powerhouse with a large dorsal fin on his head, proved popular enough to get its own animated series and extended publication into a second decade. Larson set a record as having the longest uninterrupted tenure of artist and character in comic book history. Jim Valentino also made history with his urban vigilante, Shadowhawk, who began his crime-fighting career after being intentionally infected with the HIV virus. Shadowhawk would be the first major comic book superhero to die from complications from AIDS. More than 20 years after its inception, Image Comics is still hanging in there with scores of different titles, including the zombie phenomenon The Walking Dead. Perhaps more than any one character or title, Image contributed the final breakthrough of comic book superheroes from childhood to adolescence to adulthood. As Todd McFarlane concluded, "I had a good run on Spider-Man, and I had a fun time with it. But when people ask me, 'Are you ever going to do some Marvel and DC titles?' the answer is always the same. No. Not because I think they're bad, but because it's the same answer if you ask me if I'm going back to high school. I liked high school. It was fun. But I'm not going to do it again. It's in my past. I'm looking forward." Spawn. When Spawn appeared on the scene in 1992, reeking of fire and brimstone, he transformed the dreams of a 16-year-old comic book fan from Canada into the nightmares of the next generation. Todd McFarlane had come up with the basic concept of Spawn when he was a high schooler, and even designed a full costume. When it came time to create the figurehead character for his McFarlane studio within the new Image Comics line, he pulled Spawn out of the drawer, added some fashionable spikes and chains to his look, and set forth the most popular new character of the last two decades. McFarlane's brief tenure on Batman, and more extended work on Spider-Man, came in handy. Spawn had a blood-colored version of Batman's cloak, only on steroids, and his head-to-toe covering evoked Spider-Man. He was imbued with the ruthless drive for retribution so beloved of his era, additionally enshrouded by the sulfurous fumes of the underworld. In other words, to the adolescent comic readers of the 1990s, who were listening to Nine Inch Nails on their Discmans while wearing Marilyn Manson t-shirts, he was irresistible. Spawn's origin was as carefully thought out as his costume. Al Simmons, a black covert assassin for a secret government agency, is betrayed by his boss, who puts out a contract on Simmons's life and has him killed. Simmons's lethal expertise attracts the attention of the devil, or more accurately, one of his diabolical agents, the Malebolgia. Heartbroken at being separated from his beloved wife Wanda, Simmons agrees to sign a pact with the devil in order to see her one last time. But the devil, never an advocate of fair play, sends Simmons back to Earth as a hellspawn, a hideously defigured human in a grotesque costume imbued with an infernal substance called necroplasm. Spawn, as he is now known, comes back to Earth 5 years after his death in a fetid back alley, confused and betrayed by his deal with the devil. "Why are you torturing me? What kind of sadistic pleasure are you getting from this? You want my soul? Then come get it. Just try and get it. If you're gonna screw me, I'm gonna screw you. You want my soul? Then come get it. Let's see who's got the power, you scumbag." Seeking only to communicate with his wife and to protect his family, Spawn is constantly pushed by Malebolgia into committing acts of irrevocable violence. Caught in a Manichaean crossfire, Spawn vainly attempts to draw upon the better angels of his increasingly demonic nature. The fact that Spawn was not your grandfather's superhero, or maybe not even your brother's, was made abundantly clear by the fifth issue. When a convicted pedophile and serial killer procures an early release from prison, Spawn, fearing for the safety of his wife's child, fathered by his best friend in his absence, but that's another story, tracks him down, only to find the pedophile is masquerading as an ice cream vendor. The authorities, who are investigating the pedophile on a missing child case, discover him, chained, carved up, and hanging from a rafter with a popsicle stuck in his lifeless mouth, courtesy of Spawn's demonic retribution. "He's not like a Marvel character," said McFarlane, as if that issue's gruesome final page hadn't already proved the point. "He's not like a DC character. In an image book, I can do things untethered. We didn't have a comics code. I can do R-rated comic books now if I need to." Spawn operated on an almost mathematical principle of justice. Because Batman, for example, refuses to kill the Joker and puts him in prison instead, each time the Joker escapes and kills 10 people, the blood is on Batman's gloves. In Spawn's and McFarlane's consciousness, if you eliminate the villain from the get-go, you're a step ahead of the game. "He doesn't want to be the hero. He wants to lead a normal life," said McFarlane. "He has his own needs, and he lets his emotions dictate his policy. That would never happen to a guy like Superman. He's too refined for that." What Spawn lacked in refinement, he made up for in irony. The devil had cursed him with yet another obstacle. Every instance he used his superpowers, he expended a kind of reverse energy which limited his time on Earth, a kind of existential library fine. Still, Spawn allotted his necroplasmic powers to impressive effect. He scrawled, "I beat my kids," all over the body of a child abuser. That didn't work out so well. It only made the abuser beat his kids more, and turned a rabid and vicious clan leader into a black man who was ultimately lynched by his own gang. It was also ironic to McFarlane, and some of his readers, that Spawn was both a black character and not a black character. Spawn's ravaged and decomposing skin allowed McFarlane to have a non-white hero at the center of his universe while not making it a defining aspect of his character. As McFarlane recounted, "I'd be at a comic book convention in Texas or Alabama, and guys that we would call rednecks would come up and go, 'Oh, I love Spawn. He's my favorite hero.' And I'd say, 'You remember he's a black guy, right?' And they'd look at their buddy and go, 'Oh, we did forget about that.'" The untrammeled gore and violence in Spawn's various titles, hearts were pulled out of characters' bodies as frequently as Batman tossed his batarang, helped turn him into the only character whose books sold in the millions throughout the 1990s. Comic book store owner Mike Malvey would simply shrug when little kids gravitated to the racks that held Spawn. As he said, "You can tell an 8 or 10-year-old kid you can't buy that, it's a little bloody, buy Richie Rich. But no, they want Spawn. It wasn't for them per se, but kids love Spawn." McFarlane managed to parlay that loyalty into a commercial empire that redressed nearly every wrong done to Siegel and Schuster. His own company, McFarlane Toys, dedicated itself to the first-rate production of detailed Spawn action figures, which raised the bar for the toy industry and earned millions in the process. The company diversified itself in the field and became one of the leaders in McFarlane's beloved sports collectibles. In 1997, Spawn became the first independent character to get his own eponymous feature-length film. It did not become a commercial phenomenon, which was followed up by an Emmy Award-winning HBO animated series called Todd McFarlane's Spawn, just in case anyone didn't know who was behind the character. Spawn's exploits got increasingly metaphysical as the decades wore on, and his readership dwindled. McFarlane's experimentation with such a relentlessly renegade character meant that there would never be the refuge of a secret identity, or allies, or secret caves, or, God forbid, a kid sidekick. Ultimately, the stories became repetitive in their unforgiving, driven nature. Still, it was hard not to root for a hero who loves his wife so much that he is willing to flirt with the flames of the devil's inferno. Spawn's eternal wrangling with hell was, for the right kind of reader, paradise. Doomsday, the death of Superman. He had been the standard bearer of an entire industry for decades, dedicating his superhuman life and career to moving millions of copies of comic books a year. In the wake of the grim and gritty era, however, Superman plummeted to Earth in sales, derided by certain readers as a chiseled Boy Scout without enough psychological maladjustments to make him compelling, and too downright uncomplicated to be a superstar. But in November of 1992, the Man of Steel fooled everyone. As Shakespeare says in Macbeth, nothing in his life became him like the leaving of it. Ironically, in a post-Dark Knight world, Superman's ethical clarity made his stories murky and contrived. In 1986, Alan Moore had worked with Superman's longtime artist Kurt Swan to create a wonderfully elegiac closed parentheses storyline entitled Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, which allowed fan favorite John Byrne to step in and reimagine Superman in the title The Man of Steel. This new title streamlined Superman's background and his powers into something more credible, if that's the word for an alien who streaks through the sky in a red cape. By 1991, Superman's adventures were unfurled in four separate DC Comics titles, but they were weighed down by an uninspired amalgam of predictable science fiction and quotidian problems in Metropolis. Still, those four titles required an annual organizational meeting of the various editors and writers who worked on the Superman universe to sort out and conform continuity. Much like the executive producers and showrunners of an ongoing television series, the creative staff at DC had an ongoing investment in the property and spent hours and hours spitballing possible storylines and conflicts over the course of a year. The character of Superman continued to be the biggest challenge. According to Mike Carlin, one of the editors, a lot of people feel that Superman deserves to be one of the better comics out there just because he was first. At the same time, they would also rather buy Lobo, an intergalactic mercenary, or X-Men, because Superman is kind of old-fashioned in that he doesn't like to go around killing everybody. That year, the editors met and decided, not unreasonably, the way to change things up was to have Clark Kent and Lois Lane get married. They presented the concept to DC's then publisher, Jeanette Kahn. Unbeknownst to the editorial group, Kahn had been pitching an original Superman series to the various broadcast networks and had finally convinced ABC to pick up Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, which reconfigured its leading characters into a kind of screwball comedy. Think of His Girl Friday, set at the Daily Planet. To have Clark and Lois married in the comic books would have subverted the initial bantering nature of the TV series. Kahn nixed the idea. Editor Louise Simonson recounts what happened next. So what that meant was, we had to go back and start over again. And we were a little disgruntled, and as Kahn walked out the door, editor and artist Jerry Ordway said what he always said, which is, let's just kill him. And instead of laughing it off, this time we said, yeah. Yeah, let's just kill him. And it actually seemed like a good idea. I hear today from readers who say how we did it for commercial reasons. No, we did it because we were pissed. The saga that climaxed in Superman's demise was spread out over seven separate issues of different titles, including Justice League of America. A relentless, powerful, spiny brute, ultimately dubbed Doomsday, breaks out of a secret lab and inexorably makes his way to Metropolis, destroying everything in its path. Superman comes to the rescue, but the creature is so powerful that he beats the Man of Steel back to the streets outside the Daily Planet, where an apocalyptic slugfest renders both adversaries wasted. You stopped him, exclaims Lois Lane, cradling Superman in her arms. You saved us all. Now relax until... But it was no use. After a harrowing battle in Superman number 75, rendered as 24 continuous splash pages and a climactic gatefold tableau, a Superman died. After a several-month moratorium, the DC team spun out two more story arcs, a meditation on death and loss called Funeral of a Friend, then a more explosive storyline called Reign of the Supermen, where four different costumed adventurers arrive on the scene, each claiming to be the true heir to Superman's fame and fortune. The latter series was the most inventive of the three storylines. Indeed, two of the Supermen, Steel and Superboy, now reconceived as a superclone, became permanent fixtures of the DC landscape. At the conclusion of that saga, nearly a year after his demise, having undergone a secret Kryptonian solar regeneration at the Fortress of Solitude, Superman returned, tanned, rested and ready, and with a longer haircut. No one who had ever read a comic book was surprised. But the death of such a major figure in popular culture a year earlier had stunned the media and millions of casual followers who had no idea that death and resurrection was as common in superhero comic books as it was in the New Testament. While the editorial team was planning the original storyline in early 1992, word had leaked to the press. The DC Public Relations Office literally had no clue how to handle the burgeoning interest. Companies which had licensed Superman's likeness for various products were complaining, and the whole enterprise seemed like bad news. In the world of publicity, however, there is no such thing as bad news. As Superman number 75 neared its release date of November 18, 1992, television news programs, newspapers, and magazines were heralding the death of Superman. It was front-page news, even in tabloids other than the Daily Planet. Aficionados of popular culture were having a field day, but that was nothing compared to an amateur investor market. DC Comics soon realized the death of Superman was an unprecedented bonanza and produced several commemorative versions of the issue, particularly one sealed in a black bag that included an obituary, an armband, and other collector's items. Alerting their dealers and comic book store owners across the country of the magnitude of the event, DC shipped out nearly 3 million copies. Mike Malvey owned a successful comic book store in a Phoenix mall called Atomic Comics. When he showed up for work on November 18th with boxes and boxes of Superman number 75 in the back of his van, even he was shocked. My store was by a movie theater, and that day there was a movie that opened about Martin Luther King. There was this huge line and I was like, oh wow, they must have let kids out of school to watch this movie. And then I realized, no, that's a line for my store. And there were literally hundreds of people in line to get in my store. By the end of the day, you were going to be sold out, and so you had to put limits. So I would say, look, there's a limit of 2 per customer. And this nice old lady was arguing with me and fighting with me. I need 12 of these because I've got 12 grandchildren that need to have the Death of Superman issue. I tell her, ma'am, I've got a line of 100 people here. I want to guarantee that everybody gets one. She goes, no, I was here earlier than them. Screw them. These are normal people talking like this. That once benign old lady had a point. During the previous decade, publishers had been creating collector events, tying premier issue releases to major artists, while concocting variant covers, often with gimmicks such as sealed Mylar bags, or holograms, or other collector's items. When Todd McFarlane helmed Spider-Man number 1 in 1990, the cover, of which there were several variants, unashamedly exclaimed, "First all-new collector's item issue." The issue sold 2 million copies. For veteran comics writer Marv Wolfman, the whole notion of collecting comics as a fiduciary investment is anathema to begin with. You should read the comic, you should want the comic because you love it and you want to read them, not put them away in plastic. Tied into these overinflated bonanzas were the occasional news stories that someone had found a copy of Action Comics number 1 in their grandmother's attic and it would sell at auction for a fortune. In 1992, Sotheby's auctioned a pristine copy for $82,500. In 2011, another pristine copy sold for $2.16 million. But even the lowliest intern at Sotheby's could have explained a simple fact to the ferocious old lady in line at the Atomic Comics store. It's all about supply and demand. In addition to its historical landmark status, Action Comics No. 1 had a print run of some 200,000 copies, of which roughly 130,000 were sold. There are only about 100 extant copies known to collectors. When 3 million copies of Superman No. 75 are sold, not including an additional 3 million reprints and trade paperback editions, a pertinent question remains. Who's going to buy them now? Store owners, such as Mike Malvey, saw a disturbing shift in their livelihoods, which, for most comic book store owners, had begun with a pure love of the product. As he said, people were buying Superman collector's editions 10 at a time, and buying them for their aunts and their uncles and their nieces and nephews and their dogs, I don't know. But nothing lasts forever. Suddenly I started noticing we were having cases of comics that weren't selling. We were starting to become speculators. Chuck Rosansky, the owner of the Mile High Comic Shop in Denver, said, "Frankly, I view that particular marketing event as being the greatest catastrophe to strike the world of comics since the Kefauver Senate hearings. When these new comics consumers slash investors tried to sell their copies of Superman No. 75 for a profit a few months later, they discovered that they could only recover their purchase price if they had a first printing, and their bitter disillusionment did much to cause the comics investing bubble to begin bursting. The number of comic stores across America went from 8,000 at its height to roughly 2,000 by the end of the 1990s, which was a shame because the local comic book store had provided an important social function for a burgeoning subsection of the culture. Before the direct marketing phenomenon of the 1970s, new comic books could only be found in a candy store or supermarket. Older copies could only be found by happenstance in cardboard boxes in used bookstores. Sometimes, head shops would carry posters and back issues among their psychedelic paraphernalia, but the comic book store provided one-stop shopping for the fan. Usually opening early on Wednesday mornings to accommodate the customers who craved that week's new releases, comic book shops were endearingly deferential to their clientele. As the years wore on, the shops became emporiums for more than just comics. Trade paperbacks, games, action figures, collectible statues, trading cards, toys, buttons, DVDs, and so on, most of which were produced in limited editions, marketed specifically for collectors. More important was the camaraderie found among the boxes of dog-eared back issues. The local comic book store was a place where, as the song goes about another beloved local establishment, everybody knows your name. It was a haven for the super-heroically inclined habitués. When our customers took the comics home, do you think they talked to their wives about Spawn? Asked Mike Malvey. Do you think they talked to their buddies at work about, hey, what's going on in Spider-Man? The collector's movement of the early 1990s burst forth with the same kind of unexplained, remorseless energy with which Doomsday burst forth from his underground prison. The bubble exploded almost as quickly as Doomsday was vanquished. Superman, of course, survives to this day, and although the Man of Steel has had his day in our yellow sun as an icon for commercial merchandise, even he must have chafed at the idea of being reduced to a commodity. Out of the Batcave. Gay Superheroes. The notion espoused by Frederick Wortham in the 1950s that Batman and Robin were in a homosexual relationship has always been derided as Exhibit A when critics cite the destructive ridiculousness of Wortham's crusade against comics. But, let's be honest, hasn't this thought, however fleetingly, crossed the mind of most adults who've read their adventures? According to Grant Morrison, such an inference was, quote, an inevitability. You could quite easily dial up those epicene qualities of the Batman myth in an adult way, this Plutonian, lawless man who lives in a cave and recruits young boys to help him in a vague and obscure war against crime. Yeah. But for the children who were reading those books, and even probably for the young servicemen who were reading them, it was all about adventure, and there was no sexuality in those stories at all, really. Still, it is a funny perspective. It is a perspective reinforced by essential elements in superhero mythology. Guys and gals with secret identities dress up in colorful tights and capes and step out into the night. Michael Chabon meditated on this idea in a 2008 essay in The New Yorker called Second Skin. Superheroism is a kind of transvestism. Our super drag serves at once to obscure the exterior self that no longer defines us, while betraying, with half-unconscious panache, the truth of the story we carry in our hearts, the story of our transformation, of our story's recommencement, of our rebirth into the world of adventure, of story itself. Artist Phil Jimenez sees a more direct connection to the superhero universe and gay culture. Certainly I've been to enough conventions to know that superhero comics have an enormously large gay fan base. I often get in trouble sometimes for saying that superheroes are essentially big drag queens. They are disguises that normal people put on to go behave outrageously. It's drag. It's costume. It's larger than life. The notion that you're a mild-mannered kid at school, but when you take off your shirt elsewhere, not literally, of course, you reveal that you are something underneath, that's a very potent metaphor for gay kids. In a 2010 New York Times story by George Jean Gustinez, a book editor named Dan Avery was interviewed at Skin Tight, a regular social event at the historic Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village, where attendees dress up in spandex as their favorite superheroes. Growing up in the 1980s, I guess I didn't even think gay superheroes or supporting characters were a possibility. I do remember feeling like I had two secrets I had to keep, being gay and being a comic book fan. I'm not sure which I was more afraid of people discovering. The emergence of the first unapologetically gay character would appear in 1992, in the pages of Alpha Flight, a Marvel Comics title about a Canadian superhero group with its roots appropriately in the universe of the X-Men, who, in its acceptance of outsiders, had preached tolerance for decades. However, the journey to an out hero was fraught with difficulty. The comics code had specifically proscribed depictions of homosexuality, which they initially referred to as, quote, deviancy, until 1989, and some early attempts at showing gay characters were not always salubrious. In one infamous Incredible Hulk tale in 1980, the monster's alter ego Bruce Banner is almost sexually assaulted by two men in a YMCA. The Alpha Flight story, in issue number 106, featured one of its leading characters, North Star, yet another super-streaking speedster previously distinguished only by his French-Canadian name, Jean-Paul Beaubier. While trying to save an AIDS-infected baby, North Star runs afoul of a retro Canadian hero from the 1940s, Major Maple Leaf, that's his name, whose son has died of AIDS. Furious that his son has been marginalized, Maple Leaf takes out his frustrations on North Star, who, in the heat of battle, proclaims, "I am gay," which only makes Maple Leaf more furious, as he says, "By not talking about your lifestyle, by closeting yourself, you're as responsible for my son's death as the homophobic politicians who refuse to address the AIDS crisis." A final tableau reveals a newspaper front page with the declaration of North Star's homosexuality. If the Alpha Flight issue had its share of purple prose and contrived situations, well, it wasn't the first awkward coming out, and it wouldn't be the last. North Star's declaration threw open the doors of the spandex closet. Even the New York Times editorial page commented on it. Mainstream culture will one day make its peace with gay Americans. When that time comes, North Star's revelation will be seen for what it is, a welcome indicator of social change. Other Marvel characters who followed in North Star's fleet footsteps were Hulkling and Wiccan, two young Avengers who maintain a committed relationship. when two other male, somewhat mysterious X-Forcers, Richter and Shatterstar, sealed their relationship with mainstream comics' first gay kiss in 2006, their initial creator, Rob Liefeld, who introduced the characters in 1991, expressed his displeasure on the internet. It did not earn him a lot of popularity. Peter David, who wrote the X Factor issue that highlighted Richter and Shatterstar's relationship, commented, "I understand that some parents have the same reaction. They were responsible for their children's appearances, and, when informed of their sexual persuasion, firmly declare, it's impossible. They can't be gay." Jim Lee's Image Comics imprint, Wildstorm, ran a series called The Authority, a rather grimmer version of Justice League. Its Superman-Batman avatars, the characters Apollo and the Midnighter, were not only lovers, but in 2006 were also the first gay couple to be married in superhero comics. That year, DC reintroduced the Batwoman character as having a lesbian alter ego, Kate Kane. She would eventually enter into a relationship with Renee Montoya, a lieutenant in Gotham City's police force, who would herself eventually transform into a superhero called The Question. Batwoman proposed marriage to a different girlfriend in 2013. All of this amused fans and comic book historians who remembered the original Batwoman character who was introduced in the 1950s, ostensibly to counter perceptions about Batman and Robin's relationship. During the evolution of all these other relationships, Northstar had been dating a non-superhuman named Kyle throughout his various adventures. They often found it hard to date because of Northstar's crime-fighting obligations. In spring of 2012, Northstar proposed marriage, and in issue number 51 of Astonishing X-Men, he and Kyle were married in Central Park. Presented at the height of the presidential campaign, where gay marriage had become a contentious topic, there was inevitably some discord reflected among the wedding attendees in the comic book as well. "I'm a progressive guy, but it's a lot to take in, huh?" remarked a fellow member of Alpha Flight. But the wedding, which received massive media attention, went through without a hitch. Surprising, since most weddings in the Marvel Universe involve some barrage of supervillains trying to crash the party. Northstar and Kyle rather stole the thunder that same month from DC's big news that their Earth 2 Green Lantern, based in the 1940s, was actually gay. By then, this earth-shattering news was greeted with a collective yawn by fans. Been there, done that. The Marvel Universe and the DC Universe each have about 5,000 different characters, said Phil Jimenez. The sheer size of those rosters creates a place for people of all stripes, but particularly gay ones, to connect, imagine, and project themselves in a world that reflects their own reality. An unfortunate reflection of that reality was the reaction of the conservative family values group 1 Million Moms to the marriage of Northstar and Kyle in the Astonishing X-Men. "Children desire to be just like superheroes," members posted on a website. "Children mimic superhero actions and even dress up in costumes to resemble these characters as much as possible. Can you imagine little boys saying, 'I want a boyfriend or husband like X-Men?'" The web post didn't make it clear whether the group objected to their little boys marrying a man or marrying a mutant. Wolverine. To be a popular superhero, you have to have your own idiosyncratic costume or power or tagline. Wolverine had all those, plus his own sound effect, snicked. Fandom's favorite feral fighter debuted in the summer of 1974, when he sprang forward to sharpen his claws on the Incredible Hulk. When Wolverine was fully introduced in The Incredible Hulk number 181, he was billed as, quote, "the world's first and greatest Canadian superhero." Whether or not North America was clamoring for a great Canadian superhero is open to conjecture. But Marvel Comics editor Roy Thomas certainly thought so, and asked Hulk writer Len Wein to come up with a character from the Great White North. Wein was privy to conversations at Marvel about a new international version of the X-Men that might be coming down the pike. As he said, I created him as a Canadian mutant, specifically so that whoever ended up with the assignment of writing the new X-Men book, should it ever occur, would have a Canadian mutant handy if he wanted him. As scrappy Canadian mutants go, Wolverine proved incredibly handy, especially with the ability to have six razor-sharp adamantine claws spring out of his hands. 3-foot-long claws per hand, in fact. When the new X-Men title came out in 1975, Wolverine was rather casually introduced into the group. According to Ween, it was the armor-clad Russian mutant Colossus who was primed to be the featured player. But once he found his place within the X-Men, Wolverine became, fittingly, a breakout character. He just took off like nobody's business, said Ween. Here was a character you hadn't seen much of before. Here was a hero who was a hero only by restraint. His natural instinct was to sushi you, and he would do his best not to do that. Wolverine's aggressive nature, his unsentimental wisecracks, his crush on teenmate Jean Grey, which had the potential to disrupt the X-Men, even his penchant for smoking a stinky cheroot, way back before smoking became socially incorrect, endeared him to those readers in the late 1970s and 80s who wanted a little more spice to their action heroes. Under the literary refinement of Chris Claremont and the handsome artwork of John Byrne, who succeeded Dave Cockrum on the X-Men, Wolverine evolved into a short, hirsute scrapper who bestrode both sides of an ethical conflict. Recalled Ween, in one story, Chris finally had him sushi somebody, some alien guard, and he killed the guy. All of a sudden, he was a bigger superstar. The second he became completely unpredictable, he became hugely fascinating to everybody. As befitted a comic book superstar in the late 1980s and 90s, Wolverine was spun off into several other titles, including a limited series of his own, illustrated by Frank Miller, and an extended Wolverine title that ran nearly 200 issues. Wolverine's tough guy loner status allowed him to fill the boots of other figures with the same archetype. Various storylines recast him either literally or figuratively as a samurai warrior or a gunslinger from the Wild West or a private investigator or a government secret agent and secret weapon. There were several constants, however, his ongoing war with his violent nature and his amusing way with the tough guy cliche. I'm an X-Man. Mutants like me, band of superheroes, good people, idealists, dreamers, forever looking for the best in others. With them, killing is a last resort. With me, it's second nature. I take the world as it is and give better than I get. Come at me with a sword. I'll meet you with a sword. You want mercy? Show a little first. Introduced in 1974 as Canada's Weapon X, Wolverine has always had a complicated relationship with his country of origin. How he was abducted by the Canadian government in the first place, what he was meant to accomplish, even when he was born, these were questions asked by Wolverine and readers over the course of decades. In a 2001 miniseries, he was given a very specific family history, a cross between Wuthering Heights and The Shining. With no other alter ego than the same simple name, Logan, Wolverine's other constant was his quest to discover who he is and, literally, what he was made of. His imperviousness made him an ideal subject for a science experiment, so Wolverine became a guinea pig for a test that grafted adamantium claws onto his skeleton, adamantium being the house impervious metal in the Marvel Universe. As his background was progressively explored in various comics, it became relatively clear that his mutant power was not his ability to retract his claws or his astounding agility, but his ability to regenerate his body tissue and sustain any injury within bounds without much ado. He also had the power to consume unlimited amounts of alcohol without getting drunk. A neat trick. Wolverine's appeal expanded with the 2000 film X-Men, where he was thrillingly embodied by Australian actor Hugh Jackman. Despite their differences in height, Jackman is nearly a full foot taller than Wolverine's official height, Jackman has become welded to Wolverine as if he were one of his adamantine claws. Playing the character in 5 feature-length films, 2 of which feature Wolverine solo, and 1 cameo in X-Men First Class, in which, upon a recruitment request from Professor X and Magneto, he tells them to go fuck themselves. The Jackman-Wolverine Association is the most enduring in history. No other actor has played one comic superhero in as many films. As Chris Claremont, who knows Wolverine better than anyone, maybe even better than Wolverine knows himself, put it, "The thing for me about Wolverine is that he is a man forever in primal conflict. There is a part of him that, if you cross him, he will kill you and not even blink. But there's another part of him that is a man, and his entire life is dedicated to overcoming the monster within the man. And he can't. But because he's an X-Man, he's got to keep trying." Anyone with anger management issues could relate to Wolverine's struggles, but so could readers who were intrigued by one of the paradoxes of superhero literature, that even the toughest guy on the block cared enough to devote his life to helping others. Grant Morrison saw the appeal in genre terms. He was an outsider. The boy fans wanted to be like him because he was the cool one, the outsider. But he was a good guy with a heart of gold, and the women who read the book, and the gay readers who read the book, X-Men was very popular with women and gay readers, they wanted to save him. As time has gone on, Wolverine Logan has worked with the Avengers as well as the X-Men, and shows no sign of slowing down, perhaps a result of his mutant regeneration abilities. A 2011 limited series by Mark Miller and Steve McNiven called Old Man Logan has him living 50 years into the future, out on a farm in California, surrounded by beasties and baddies, prepared to take up the sushiing game once again, just an inveterate anti-hero with a snicked in his heart. Women in Refrigerators. Battle of the Superheroines. "That little lady sure is tough," remarked a male bystander on the 3rd page of Ms. Marvel's first adventure in 1977. "She makes Linda Carter look like olive oil." That ostensibly enthusiastic statement packs much of the trials and tribulations of being a female superhero at the end of the 20th century, as well as the role of women creators, editors, and readers within the overwhelmingly boyish men's club that is the comic book universe. Ms. Marvel was a character whose alter ego had existed in the Marvel Universe for nearly half a century. She first appeared as Major Carol Danvers in one of the last original superhero titles of the 1960s, Marvel Superheroes. Danvers was a NASA security officer who tangled with a new character named Captain Marvel, a somewhat uninspired character who was actually a military officer from an alien race called the Kree named Mar-Vell. It was important to Stan Lee, Mar-Vell's creator, and publisher Martin Goodman that the Captain Marvel name be wrangled from legal oblivion after the Fawcett character vanished in 1951. In one issue, Danvers was rescued by Mar-Vell from an explosive bolt of radiation from the Psyche Magnetron, expended by a Kree adversary. Unbeknownst to either of them, Carol absorbed some of the energy through Captain Marvel, and her human DNA was fused with Kree DNA, or the alien equivalent. She had become a sleeper superheroine. 8 years later, Lee wanted to create a new title with a superpowered woman at the center of it and called Danvers up for active service. Along with Jerry Conway, they spliced together the Marvel name with the prefix that signified the women's liberation movement, giving the new character that unique mixture of trendiness and corniness which typified the Marvel Universe. Danvers was now an editor of a woman's magazine, Shades of Gloria Steinem, whom she resembled, published begrudgingly by none other than J. Jonah Jameson, Spider-Man's nemesis. She frequently suffered from dissociative blackouts when she would turn into the feminist warrior Ms. Marvel, whose powers included super strength, flight, courtesy of a Kree-engineered suit with matching scarf, and a 7th sense that alerted her to danger. Ms. Marvel zoomed across the Marvel Universe in her own title for several years before it was canceled. At least she got a much sexier costume in the process. But the demise of her comic book was nothing.